that's a big area that we've been focused on. What can we do as a telco to help lift up productivity for New Zealand and help make small businesses more productive ultimately, and just make telco an easy thing to consume?
The New Zealand Tech Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, proactive and strategic IT.
Hey folks, greetings and welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Spain. Today, we're with Stephen Kujaya, who is the Chief Technology Officer at 2Degrees. Welcome along, Stephen. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me and pronouncing my name so well.
Well, thanks for the help in advance on that one. I do try. Sometimes I get these things wrong. Polish name, is it?
It is a Polish name, yep. Half Polish. My father from Poland, mum from England. They migrated here in the 70s to the mighty, Rotorua, in fact, around the Bay of Plenty, then to Tauranga.
Oh, that's where my family came out to, in a similar time zone, time frame.
Yep, that's my hometown, Tauranga.
Oh, very good. Well, really keen to sort of, you know, dive in today. There's lots going on always in the technology world. The telecommunications world is the same. And I think before we started, you were saying, well, we're not really a telco, we're a software company first, and telecommunications is obviously, you know, a key part of you know, what you sell. Have I got that sort of roughly right? You might say it slightly differently.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And I say that, you know, being a network engineer in my background as well. Ultimately, I think of our company as a software company with great telco assets. We've got a really great world-class network, but how our customers consume the network is through software, through service. So a lot of our focus is actually how do we activate that and build that software capability. So it's been a huge focus of ours for quite a few years. And that's how we think of ourselves. It's not a technical capability as such. It's actually how do we wire our organization for fast feedback, and how do we deliver for our customers quickly and innovatively. So
great. Well, before we jump in, of course, big thank you to our show partners, which includes 2Degrees, 1NZ, Spark, HP, and Guerrilla Technology. So we appreciate their support, not only of the New Zealand Tech Podcast, but the broader sort of tech and innovation ecosystems here in New Zealand. So I guess it'd be interesting for listeners to know sort of, you know, what's your background? When we were chatting before the show, you're talking about working at Maxnet sort of 20 odd years ago.
Yep.
How did you get started in this big wide world of technology?
Where do we start from 4 years old? No. I guess my journey was in a way, it's kind of fate, I think, getting back into telco, because I didn't go down that path initially. I just like solving hard problems. Loved technology as a young kid, started up my own BBS, you know, I was the guy.
Bulletin boards.
Yeah, I was the person that was in the back of a telecom exchange trying to find spare parts and that sort of thing. But never saw a career in it and never really kind of thought about that. So what did I do instead? I went down a kind of science pathway, studied physics, mathematics. I did electronics as well. Did a master's thesis in quantum physics. And started a PhD in a similar thing, actually in quantum teleportation. But while I was doing that, I was doing some contracting on the side and doing software development, which kind of got my taste into kind of other areas. But weirdly enough, the work I was doing back all those years ago at the University of Auckland, and New Zealand's probably not well known in terms of what it's done on the world stage in quantum physics, but it was kind of the foundations of a quantum internet. So the quantum teleportation piece was kind of part of that. But I've left that part, although I think about it a bit, what could have been down an academic pathway, I took a different pathway, and then I ended up in a small company called Maxnet. It was one of the range of small ISPs that started up in the kind of mid-90s, late 90s. As the market was changing, I started it as a software developer. It was a great experience, just being the only software developer in a small company, and you get to see everything happening. You get to see your work that matters. Mm. And in a way, I'm trying to replicate that again at 2Degrees. So what I've learned in that kind of what was, you know, you didn't talk about agile and squads and all these things. You actually just did the work in a small startup. Yes. How do you replicate that on a bigger scale? Yeah, so being a software company is actually how do you replicate that on that bigger scale. But my journey from there, I left Maxnet, joined Core Plus, and then we've had a lot of mergers and acquisitions along the way. eventually in the 2 Degrees family. So we all have our different origin stories. Been at the organization for 17 years, which seems like a long time, but it's not really. It changes every few years. It keeps it all very interesting. And my remit is Chief Technology and Information Officer. So it's across software, security, data, the network, your mobile network, your fixed network, and all the other parts around technology that we don't think about often, like your laptop, corporate IT things, retail, IT staffing, anything to do with technology. But what I'm really passionate about is how do we connect that technology to our customers, and that's what I think about a lot every day.
That's great. Lots in there.
And if you want to delve into quantum physics anytime.
Well, I was going to say, you talk about quantum teleportation. Are we going to be able to teleport ourselves? What did you land on in those regards?
Yep. That's a good question. And often you have an analogy drawn to Star Trek and teleportation. But the weird thing about quantum is it's completely different. So it's actually not really teleportation. It's actually how do you transfer information from one quantum object to another. And that's really hard in the quantum world because as soon as you measure something, it changes. So the kind of traditional classical teleportation would be more like a replication of you, kind of mapping you out. Maybe that's where the AI digital twin parts sort of come in. From a quantum part, it's quite interesting because you can then build, and these are real things now, you can build quantum encrypted channels that you can never break them, because if you do try to do a man in the middle, the entire state collapses. So it's got the physical properties are built in to be secure.
That's pretty cool.
And those things are actually being used in defense areas across the world now. So I think what was for me kind of, this is an interesting thing, you know, this going back to the 90s and, you know, quantum computers were talked about back then. AI was talked about back then. We had the AI winter for 50 years. But I'm now winding the clock forward to 2024. What I was studying there is actually now 25 years later sort of coming to fruition. So I find it quite fascinating the things that sometimes humans can maybe underestimate or overestimate technology changes.
Fascinating. Now, probably lots and lots that we can delve into. It's been sort of between 18 months and 2 years since 2 Degrees and Vocus, merged. So lots that's been going on. What can you tell us around that journey? What are the things that have gone well? What are the things that have, you know, probably maybe more complicated than you would have liked? I think we've all seen over the years the sort of, you know, varying things with challenges related to bringing software together. We've certainly had one or two telcos over the years that have got stuck years and years and years into having acquired a company, and they still haven't managed to merge systems. So walk us through those aspects.
Yeah, so it has been nearly 18 months. So from what was the 1st of June 2022, two organizations came together and we had to hit the ground running. And a lot of it is things that you wouldn't even think of, you know, some of the basic stuff to start with. We made some really key decisions early on, but things like just how do you have a single identity on your laptop? How do we get people in the same building under the same communication platforms? And we had to do that really quickly to get our teams actually connecting and getting the culture right. So those sorts of things you don't think about are actually really important. We actually physically relocated people in offices and got all that working quite quickly. And then the key decisions around systems and technology stacks that we made very early. Through our journey and my journey for over 17 years in the organization, we have had a lot of mergers and acquisitions. We do have a playbook and how we do it, but every time it's different. So there are always different aspects. Yeah. But probably the key theme is it's kind of a disagree and commit piece, because there's always emotional attachment to certain things as well. So make decisions quickly, communicate the why, and then just get on with
get
it.
Get on and get it done.
And do it incrementally. So rather than what would be a traditional kind of big bang, multi-year digital transformation effort, and we've probably seen many in the news around those that don't work. It's how do you do it incrementally? So a lot of the thinking is how do we, this is the really interesting part. And one of my hats was an architecture hat for a long time, is how do you take legacy and modernize it? And where do you look at the kind of fracture planes in technology to do that, to kind of glue bits together? How do you do transitional architectures? So that's kind of the technical part. I've got some really smart people in the team that have worked through that to make these things more seamless. So we're 18 months through. We've already had some good wins. Part of it is also belief. So we're building a lot of our platforms internally. I think our competitive advantage is actually we do have a lot of in-house capability. In my team, I've got around 450 technologists in some way. Over 100 of them are software developers. So we've got quite a sizable software development capability here in New Zealand. But in saying that also, it's democratized. So there are a lot more people that do software as well. So we're trying to democratize it. So yeah, a really great team that are building this capability. So we've had some, early on it was around how do we create belief that we can do this in-house for a lot of things. And we had some wins early on and deliverables that we delivered as we said we would, and the belief grew. But we've still got a lot more work to do. So the big part of it is how do we unify these systems so we can have a great customer experience. So we still have two main stacks that our customers sit on, and we're quite close to actually getting these together right now. So we've got probably still another 6 to 12 months of really hard work, and it's not all glamorous stuff. There's certain people that like legacy and working through that. But we're doing it in a way that is always customer first. So how do we create a seamless customer experience when you're migrating from one system to another? We've got to unify the customer experience layer. And then can we add more onto it? So while we're trying to maybe do a like for like in terms of customer experience, can we actually improve it along the way is what we're always looking at in terms of opportunities. So a lot of work that's been happening. And alongside of that is things that you don't talk about as well, data modernization. When you're moving systems, you need to modernize your data warehousing and all that stuff. Cybersecurity is a huge one as well. While you're doing this work, it needs to be secure. You know, threats are always persistent and growing. So there's a lot of aspects that we're trying to do. And that's the integration piece, but we're also growing. So we've been really growing in the market across the last 18 months as well in all segments. So we are in the consumer segment, mass market, in the business segment for corporate, government, medium-sized enterprise, small, which I think often New Zealand may not know that segment that we play in because we are serious about business, and also wholesale. So those are our key areas, and we do work in all of those spaces. And one of my key passion areas, and I work a lot alongside Andrew Fairgrey, who's our chief business officer, is how do we grow in that business segment? I just see so much opportunity in terms of productivity for New Zealand that we can do. So that's a big area that we've been focused on. What can we do as a telco to help lift up productivity for New Zealand and help make small businesses more productive ultimately, and just make telco an easy thing to consume?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because 2 degrees. I think a lot of people would probably think of you as more that sort of consumer focus. So it's interesting to hear. And I guess that for a lot of the Vocus business was business.
A lot of it,
enterprise and I guess some government sort of customers and so on in there, right?
And that's growing. And the network itself is considered a critical national significant asset. So if the network's having a bad day, New Zealand's having a bad day. So we're really focused on the reliability of our network. We've got all sectors, local councils, different industries, emergency services. So, reliability is hugely important. Having the uptime is significantly important for us. So we invest a huge amount in reliability and diversity of the network. But that is what we consider bread and butter. But it's a bit of a secret in New Zealand, I think, that we don't, a lot of people don't know that we have this network that we own, over 4,000 kilometers of fiber and the mobile network as well attached to that. So I guess our challenge is how do we change that perception a bit and activate that more? Because once we start talking to people and customers, they actually understand it, they love us. So that's our challenge going forward, I think, is we have the telco assets, we have the software capability. How can we actually just change perception a little bit in the market?
Yep. So how would you use the fibre today that you you know that 2 degrees owns? What are the
because I think
for most of us, if we think it's sort of home or business internet connection.
Yeah, so this is a little bit different. Yeah,
you know, then that's got its particular role, but there's also the importance of, you know, connecting assets and the country together. So you know, the backbone is really important, right?
Yeah, so the backbone is exactly what it is. It's connecting cities together. So that's the fibre network that spans from, you know, top of New Zealand down to the bottom. And there are probably, I guess you'd say, 4 major national backbone fibre networks in New Zealand today. This one is one of them. And interestingly, a part of our story, I think some people know the 2 degrees effect and what happened overnight with when 2 degrees launched mobile, and overnight it created a huge economic benefit for New Zealand, quoted by the Reserve Bank, you know, $15 billion of economic value. Our heritage and fighting for fear has been across all these different origin stories. We had Slingshot that kind of created a ISP overnight and was fighting David and Goliath. But the fiber network has a similar story. So FX Networks, which is probably a name that maybe not a lot of people have heard of, they actually was one of our origin companies, built the fiber network in a time when it was dominated by incumbents. And that's a huge investment to do, and it requires a lot of backing and leadership to do it. So, FX Networks actually changed the game in that backbone backhaul environment at the same time, and that was before Chorus existed in terms of that separation. So another part of our origin story and how we're trying to drive competition. And there's many examples like that. So that's one that's often forgotten about, but that's part of our heritage. And the network itself is used to just transfer huge amounts of data. A lot of it still is kind of Auckland origin, but it's bandwidth. We have optical networks that sit over the top that are running in the terabits per second on a single fiber. It's all great, fascinating stuff, you know, high speed lasers and electronics. And it's also secure. So we have these fibers that are highly secure. So we have customers that, you know, buy direct fiber because they want direct fiber to a data center and another data center. So the security aspect is really important. And other different use cases on the fiber network, but predominantly it's to connect cities together. Fascinating stuff. And connecting mobile towers as well onto the fiber network is another key aspect. So it's not just your local fiber companies. It's this fiber asset is used for a range of things like that.
Yep. Now, with varying weather events and so on, you know, we have found ourselves with mobile towers that were not connected, right? Going back, was it a year ago now? 2 years?
Cyclone Gabrielle, it was just over a year ago.
Looking back there, what have been the lessons and sort of changes from there? And of course, part of this crosses into a time where access to satellite connectivity has much improved over the last couple of years. So how has that sort of changed for your network to provide sort of increased resiliency going forwards?
Yeah, I mean, the event was I guess it was something we'd never seen before, because the extent of the damage wasn't localized. So we've had other events that have been more localized. Obviously we've had 3 national emergencies but the other 2, Christchurch and COVID was another one. It was a different sort of issue, but this was really, really spread. So it did spread our field services quite a lot as well. The people on the ground that were doing the hard work. From the backhaul perspective, that was a quick turnaround on how do we use Starlink business grade backhaul on a mobile cell tower. And that was something we had already been testing in the lab, and we rolled it out relatively quickly. The team did an amazing job to get that out. Many factors around access and discussions around, the battery life in a cell tower, generator use, how do you get fuel into a site? It's all around access. How do you get to the basic needs? There's been a lot more discussion around that, and also with particularly our bigger corporate customers, they're very interested in getting resilience for their own services. So our Starlink business broadband package has been working really well for our business customers as well that want to, they might have a primary fiber or even a secondary fixed wireless access and then a third option with Starlink. There's been other discussions around community hubs. We've done work with Network for Learning recently, connecting schools with Starlink. And those are examples where you could still have a hub where people can get to that still has a connectivity pathway. I mean, the great thing about low Earth orbit satellite is it goes up and it comes back down to a different ground station, a different area. So it is truly diverse from that aspect. You just need power. So having a community hub aspect is something we're working on with a few places as well. But yeah, it's an evolving thing around resilience and that discussion that we're actively working with our industry partners on as well.
So it's a bit of a journey to a point where you'd be able to say, hey, we've got, you know, satellite, you know, backhaul options on you know, a very high percentage of remote sort of cell sites. It's not something that takes 5 minutes to do.
Yeah, permanently is a bit challenging, but having it in a deployable state is what we're doing so they can be deployed quickly. So part of it is how do we respond quickly. And then your other aspect is the direct-to-cell technology that is evolving as well in a state of emergency. Just making a phone call or a text message was really important. You know, when Gisborne and Hawke's Bay were, you know, in some cases, some parts were cut off, just being able to contact a family member. I had family members in the region. It's like, how do we contact them? So having that like instant emergency response is really critical. And that's where the LEO direct to satellite cell tower in the sky, I think, will play a big part going forward as well. So kind of complement the resilience discussion.
What does that journey look like? You're working with Link. You know, I guess they're sort of a smaller firm if you put them next to, say, SpaceX, right?
So the gorilla.
So you've got SpaceX with all their own launch, you know, capabilities, and Starlink, which we've mentioned that they're able to kind of, I guess, you know, started tagging on to some of those Starlink, you know, satellites, some of that direct-to-cell type of technology. How do you see that sort of journey playing out? Well, you know, where will we be in 12 months, 24, 36? Is it a decade away until we've got complete everything on our mobiles when we're in those, you know, distant rural locations? How do you see that?
Like I said at the beginning, in quantum physics, hard to predict the future, isn't it, sometimes? But, yeah, I guess
I expect complete accuracy, Stephen.
Yeah, you're quoting me on it.
Your kind of thoughts on how it plays out. And we know that, look, you know, you can't control what other firms do and so on. But, you know, what would you sort of expect it to look like?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is space is really hard. So, yeah, like you say, there's all the caveats in there. But it is evolving. So, yeah, our partnership with Link, they've got 5 satellites up now. Our CEO, Mark Callender, actually went over to see a space launch 2 months ago. I didn't get the invite.
I was a little bit jealous on that one,
too. Me too, in fact. Yeah.
Someone invite me.
Yeah, I know. So they are launching. They're launching with other launch partners. And it is improving. So we took quite a pragmatic approach to it. We're not going out, you know, bullishly saying this is going to solve everything. So we know space is hard and this stuff is hard, and you're not going to get necessarily in-building coverage. It's going to be certain times of day when it's happening. And we did our first text message and voice call last year, which was really exciting stuff. Like, who would have ever thought technology could get to this point when you've got satellites like whizzing around 500 kilometers in the air? It's fantastic. But I still think you're in the horizon of probably 2 years to have something, I think, really compelling. Mm. And you've got other players in the market as well, in the market and trying to, in this race, Amazon, AST Space Mobile. So there's a range of activity going on. There's a lot of funding from different areas. So I don't think it'll be a one-horse race necessarily with SpaceX and Starlink. Yep. They do have a lot of launch capability, don't get me wrong, and they're getting their new big rocket ready to go where they can launch huge amount of satellites. But it still will be an ecosystem, I think. And we're really excited to be part of it. Link have been a great partner for us because it's just been quite an easy way to work with them and just get some learnings and actually see it working. We did some more trials down in Nelson, so it's great for emergency use cases right now. So it's not a, you know, you don't have 100% coverage everywhere, but it's going to evolve. And we'll just be keeping updated as it progresses. We're not making bold claims around this. It's just, you know, progressively as it improves, we'll just be communicating with our customers and the market around what's happening. But yeah, fascinating. There's also many fascinating aspects. One that we don't talk about a lot, which is not the direct to cell, but it's the satellite to satellite space lasers. So creating new low latency pathways, which were traditionally tied to or tethered to fiber optic subsea builds. Imagine like a case of New Zealand and, you know, South America being able to communicate on a low pathway. That's those are interesting, and that's probably going to open up as well. But that's tied to some regulation aspects as well, because you have to have your connection coming back down in the same geographic area at the moment. So, but that could open up whole different use cases. Bandwidth might be still lower than a terrestrial subsea, but you've got this low latency aspect. I know the gamers would love that for sure.
So financial
institutions, I'm sure there's other parts.
So rather than a subsea subsea fiber optic cable from here to, let's just say, Chile or wherever, you could basically have a dynamic satellite connection. Then laser from one satellite to another, or would they go through sort of multiple?
They go through multiple satellite hops,
so you'd be able to do those kind of hops with laser.
Again, bleeding edge technology, but it's all possible.
And then back down.
So speed of light, it's faster in a vacuum than it is in a cable too. So it's actually faster.
I was just kind of curious about that. So doing it that way, going up to space and back down, you potentially would have a quicker communication, lower latency than going via an undersea fiber optic cable.
You would, in theory.
In
theory, bandwidth would be the biggest challenge initially, because it would be, how do you line these things up to actually communicate with space lasers and do it reliably? So, but that's what I see is definitely something that's been fascinated about the subject for many years, like 10 years ago. This is a potential LEO's coming, and it's here now. The future is not far away.
We had it's a while since I've spoken with him, George Lee, who Kiwi guy who ended up getting he was at NASA in the US, and he ended up probably in Australia, but he was working on the space lasers and sort of communication from satellite to satellite and so on. Quite an interesting field. It might be time for us to catch up with him and
see where it's at. He can tell you what's really going on.
Where some of those things are going. But so you think that there is the potential to have enough bandwidth to make that sort of connectivity something that would be, that it'd actually be, you know, able to take a, you know, more than a fraction of a percent of sort of communication between, say, New Zealand and South America?
Yeah, I think so. It's going to be another big avenue. And latency is a critical thing for certain applications. So everyone wants to – you've seen the financial institutions that are running direct fibers between to do trading. So there's many different scenarios where I think latency would be more important than actually bandwidth capacity. So, yeah, and just another avenue to consider in this whole LEO dynamic that's happening, direct to cell. We've already got the Starlink broadband services that are really great in New Zealand, because we have a really good position in the world to actually get line of sight to satellites. So that's really going well. We connected the Chatham Islands, probably we're going back 18 months ago actually, with Starlink. So these are making tangible differences to digital equity already, and we kind of see it as complementary to what we're doing. You've got UFB, you've got fixed wireless access, you've got LEOs all coming in just to have good choices for New Zealanders. So, exciting times in the telco industry.
Now, eSIMs, onto another topic. So, this has sort of been, I guess, you know, progression for mobile sort of carriers around the world. and I guess for, you know, smartphone makers have moved to eSIMs being, you know, quite an important, you know, element. And in fact, is it the US where now when you buy an iPhone that they only take eSIMs? I could be jumping to a conclusion there, but I'm pretty sure
we'll fact check that.
That's, yeah. That has started to happen. But here, yeah, in New Zealand, you know, you buy an iPhone, you know, you can put one physical SIM in and one eSIM. So things seem to have moved in that direction, which, is interesting, can be very, very, you know, helpful from a flexibility perspective. You know, you even see, you know, when people are traveling, they can go and buy an eSIM effectively for, you know, any country. Well, I don't know about any country, yep, but, you know, you can go and line those things up before you get somewhere, yep, if you're trying to sort of save on you know, roaming costs and what have you. But there's that aspect of the wearables and being able to have sort of, you know, one number across a smartwatch and a phone. Where's 2 degrees on that front? Seems these things are a little bit more complicated than just ticking a couple of boxes on screen and turning on all the capabilities.
It would be nice if it's the case. So we launched eSIM back in August 2022. I'd say we were a little bit behind. We're highly self-critical of ourselves. We always want to do better. We've been working hard to get the next sort of part of that, which is the wearables piece. So it should be only in a couple of months. In July, we'll have a wearables component with Samsung, and hopefully we're working hard just to get the rest of it done. So I can't sort of mention timeframes on the other parts. But all the other kind of basic mechanics of things that you don't think about. I originally thought, you know, SIMs are like this 1980s technology that you're putting in a smartphone. It's like putting a cassette tape in a smartphone, right? It's like, why would you do that? But going to eSIM actually opens up all these other aspects that you didn't think about. How do you transfer an eSIM from one phone to another? When you're doing a phone swap, that was easy with a physical one because you just pull it out, plug it in. How's that journey work?
Yep.
Converting from physical to eSIM. So we've done all of that work. So you we have eSIM capability. You can go on an iPhone and go from a physical to an eSIM. We've got a whole lot of sign-up journeys. The wearables part is something that we're just on the final parts of getting sorted, which it'll be really exciting. I see you've got your watch on yourself on watch lists at the moment. Yeah, so imminent is what I would say. I'm really keen to see it in action myself. It's great freedom to have your wearable independent from your phone. Coming really soon.
Yep. That's good to hear. Now, artificial intelligence, especially sort of generative AI, has really been, you know, almost all we seem to talk about when it comes to tech over the last
we haven't been talking about it yet.
18 months. You know, where does it fit in for you and for 2 degrees at this point?
Yeah, are we deep fake? I don't know. Are we actually real people if we're people watching us on the podcast? Or are they real voices? You know, there's we're on a journey, on a learning curve. So the excitement, obviously, with ChatGPT launching, it was, you know, everyone's kind of, it's become the most accessible thing, right? It's been, from a kind of worldwide perspective, just this easy way to get into AI. We've been doing AI generally for a little while, machine learning, Turing prediction models, all of these things, probably for a bit of over a decade in some ways. But taking a fresh perspective with generative AI, we've, been doing a few things, but taking it as a way. It's not an AI strategy. We're not doing it for the sake of technology. It's actually how do we improve and execute on our strategy quicker as a turbocharger? And, you know, how profound is it? You know, is it all hype? Is it actually something real? I'm on the side of an optimist, and I think there's quite a profound change happening. But there is definitely a huge amount of hype in the market. I talk to my peers, other CIOs, CTOs, and there is a bit of this FOMO going on as well. It's like, yes, what are you doing? What are you doing? Because they hear things, you know, that's because you put your best Instagram post up, right? This is this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
So we're taking, again, quite a pragmatic approach. And it's been in a way to bring people on the journey. So there's a whole bunch of enthusiasm. So we're using the simple things, which I think will be table stakes around employee productivity. We're utilizing Microsoft Copilot in a small group. doing things like team summarization, you know, all of those good things around generating actions out of meetings and
How do you find those things? Because I guess experiences I've had with some of these tools is the hype is often way better than the actual sizzle isn't much of a real kind of result that comes out. And you mentioned team sort of meeting summarization. I've seen things there where whole segments of a meeting, whether it's a particular word or subject or someone's voice or accent and so on, can just if you're completely relying on that kind of you're gonna be in a big hole if you haven't actually been taking the human kind of notes as it were, right?
We're measuring. Sort of trying to measure it quantitatively and qualitatively our groups of users. But overall, I think we had around 70% said they improved quality. We've just on those kind of what I call table stakes things, it'll be around employee productivity. They've said the top users kind of pragmatically saved around 10 hours per month.
That's over 2 weeks a year, right?
The challenge is, where can I spend my two weeks? Yeah, yeah. What do you fill?
It doesn't work quite like that usually, does it? In business,
what do you fill that with? Yeah. So you can improve a 5-minute task or a 1-hour task. Yeah. You can get a better quality outcome. There's a great study by BCGX around this jagged frontier, and it was about cyborgs and centaurs around how to use AI. There's different people that use it in different ways. One more as a co-pilot, as co-intelligence, like a coach, actually give me this information and then kind of iterate. And there's others that kind of use it just as a machine, go do this for me, bring it back. So great research if anyone wants to look at it. There's a really good book called Co-Intelligence as well, which goes through all these different aspects. I'd highly recommend it as well. So there's that part of it, which we're kind of growing and just learning, testing and learning, because I don't think anyone really knows. But Microsoft's products are getting better and better as we move forward.
These things are iterating.
And have interesting cases of things that you may not expect as well, where you have you get the kind of sentiment of a Teams meeting where employees are talking to each other and goes, this person doesn't like this person. So, you know, the Teams is wrapping up some sort of sentiment in there. It's like, oh, that's interesting. But the other area we're using it is in our call center. So we've got, I'd say it's still a trial phase, but it's progressively moved into production around when our agent has a call, it gets we have an auto summary that's generated by an AI model.
Yep.
So it's effectively similar to Teams meeting concept where it's generating the transcription, but then it's also analyzing that and pulling out the sentiment and intent of the call, and then we feed that back into our kind of our data models and can get some learnings out of it. So we can learn, okay, customers are calling in for this reason. Should we add more automation or more self-service, or should we be training our call center staff in a different way? So that's been, I think, quite a massive improvement for us, because traditionally sentiment intent's been really hard to analyze.
Definitely.
So that's been really successful. It does mean you can wrap up calls quicker as well, because there's a lot of time spent actually wrapping up calls and typing out notes. And our frontline staff love it as well, because it makes their lives easier.
And how does it help your frontline staff?
Just removing the laborious work of typing out notes in the wrap-up.
Yep.
So they get a head start on it. It's all transcribed. It gives them some indications.
Gotcha.
There's this thing called kind of next best action and next best experience as well. So you can kind of evolve it to the next piece. Could you have an agent with a co-pilot that could be kind of analyzing what's happening and actually give some coaching to the human and go, okay, you should be thinking about this, talking about this. So that's kind of interesting scenarios moving forward.
It does seem like there's a lot of opportunity when it comes to call center and customer service type of
huge amount. We're on a journey on that, but taking people on the ride as well, because it's there's so many ethical aspects to it. There's the bias hallucination. We've got a pretty early on, we put a responsible AI use policy in place. We've got a data AI governance forum where we talk about this stuff, because there is definitely an ethical part. There's a safety aspect as well. And the other area which I think is probably the more profound because it is around software development productivity. So we have, as I said, we consider ourselves a software company with great telco assets. So our software developers are using a Copilot to help write their code. Maybe it sounds pretty boring on the surface of it, but their productivity uplift has been significant. And if you consider, I think, you know, what's holding back a, not just, you know, 2 degrees, but any organization in the world is how do you develop software more productively? In this age of digital that we've been in from the 1970s to now, it's all been around software production. That's ultimately what we've been producing. And software, in a way, is a negative scale industry. I started off at MaxNet as one developer, and that was really productive. When you get to five developers or 100 developers like we have, how do you scale that up is something we think about a lot, and it is negative scale. The more people you add, it does get harder. Communication channels get harder. So I think probably one of the most profound things about AI is actually how does it change and lower the cost, I just mean in terms of how do you develop software better, quicker, with a Copilot will be fundamental because that'll drive the next layers of innovation. So that's exciting, and we're seeing, you know, about a 20% uplift in productivity and quality. So it's better code, better peer reviews, all these things you don't think about as a software company that you need to do. It's not just magic that happens. So yeah, I think that's quite a fundamental one for us, and that's going to keep improving. These large language models that we've only on the infancy, I think. You've got, I saw in, I think it was Twitter, around the delivery that Jensen Huang gave to Sam Altman, the new Blackwell chipset for the training of the next version of maybe GPT-5, who knows.
So we've
got Moore's Law, which we had in the past, which was doubling microprocessors every 2 years. There's the Jensen Huang law, I think, which is we're seeing a significant increase in compute power, an entire change in the industry from what was traditional compute to this accelerated compute, which is, drives other aspects, you know, how do we power it, data center capacity, all of these things. So I think it's just at the very beginning of these large models. And then you think about language and what it is. Can you train these models on other things like, you know, cellular language? What does that mean for, you know, in the biotech field and health science? So there's, you know, language and text. There's other things that these models can be pre-trained on. So there's a lot of areas. I think that's why I'm more on the optimist side. There is obviously all the caveats around, you know, is it safe to use? What happens if you get an unsecured AI model? And can you get to artificial general intelligence when the AI is actually thinking for itself?
What's your pick on the artificial AGI? General intelligence? Yeah.
When is it going to happen?
Are you someone that sort of thinks it's a long way or a never, or this is sort of something we might see over in?
Depending on the definition of it, I listened to a podcast that Sam Altman was on about a month ago. His definition is kind of a median intelligent kind of person. He wasn't talking kind of really aspirational AGI. And, you know, what we're playing with the models now kind of feels like someone's thinking. It feels a little bit magic, but it's not magic. It's just predicting text.
Yes, and that's right. Yeah.
So, I don't know. The predictions I've seen vary. Like, there's 5 years to 10 years. But I'd say maybe it's in that realm. But you just don't know. And again, it's in its infancy. Like, the amount of investment, we talk about telecommunications, capital investment, the amount of investment going into these AI factories, data centers, is going to surpass telco investment. So you're talking $7 trillion of investment. There's an arms race going on. So it's going to be fascinating. And possibly 5 to 10 years, sounds a bit scary. You know, what happens if you're the optimist or the other side? Is it Skynet taking over, or is it going to benefit the human race? So I'm on the benefit side, and as a co-pilot, definitely. But there's so many facets to kind of consider in this space. And yeah, we do still need regulation and all these things to play a part. So it's a huge component. It's different to previous technology where this can potentially go out of control.
I guess, my leaning on AGI is it's maybe not anytime soon, but I could be completely wrong, right? That's not my area of specialty, but it just seems to create that sort of intelligence is seems sort of too mind-blowing, but, you know, then again, you know, with just how good in some areas that, you know, certain aspects of AI is today is pretty surprising. And if you'd asked me 10 years ago,
would I
have been able to, you know, get my head around, you know, what we can do now? Maybe not sure. Some of these things you can definitely join up the dots and kind of see how they will happen and so on. You know, a reasonable number of years in advance. But yeah, some things end up being, you know, much, much harder.
Yeah, there's a great report that Amy Webb, she's a futurist, that she publishes every year that tracks trends, and I'd definitely recommend it. Mm-hmm. It tracks AI trends, all sorts of trends, and she says that we actually are in a technology super cycle at the moment. There's a combination of AI, biotech, and connected things all coming together at this moment in time, and she makes certain predictions about what that means in the kind of near term. So it's definitely one I think the viewers could check out. It's really good material.
Thanks for the tip. Well, we'll put those into the show notes, so people that are wondering afterwards, if you haven't been able to write that down. Now, I'm just thinking what we can squeeze in before we finish up. What's on your mind that we haven't covered that maybe you think listeners might find interesting?
Yeah, I think we're doing a lot of work to create some amazing customer experiences with our integration onto one stack. But the key area.
What are your technologies that you sort of built that on for those that are interested?
We use a lot of open source, in fact. I've always been on the curve of, you know, trying to do things a little bit different and with innovation. So we're using technology that was actually born out of Uber. You know, when you book your Uber app and you the workflow engine behind the scenes, the orchestration engine, we've actually utilized that bit of technology to orchestrate our network. So when a customer can go into, we've got a portal called Flex where a customer can log in. It's for particularly for medium-sized enterprises. They can purchase a circuit and a service and a network as a service model, so kind of not traditional telco. The orchestration technology behind the scenes to go and provision a piece of equipment in our network is all done through this engine that Uber invented, which is, I think, is pretty cool stuff. And for those that are techno inclined, we use a lot of Golang, which is came out of Google, programming language, .NET, a range of other kind of SaaS platforms as well, kind of around the edges. So, and a whole range of different databases, you know, document storage, traditional relational databases, a range of other things. And it's kind of an interesting one when you're in technology that you're trying to create guardrails around it and standardize, but you actually want to give freedom to your developers to make decisions as well, but with enough guardrails in place not to have a kind of a spaghetti mess. So I think we've struck the right balance there. So we're giving, our goal is to have teams that are autonomous, self-organizing. They can make most of their own decisions within the guardrails of our architectural roadmap, which means we can deliver fast and we can do innovative things. A lot of our innovations actually came out of, inspired from a developer's idea. We run hackathons, we have innovation days. One of our big ones is a thing we call the Tahi app, which is an internal portal for our colleagues and our frontline staff to actually interact with our systems to serve our customers really well.
Yep.
And traditionally, telcos and probably many in the industry focus a lot more on the customer self-service, but they forget their dear colleagues that are running on like 7 different internal portals. And you invest all this energy and customer experience at this end. And what matters is actually your digital experience for your colleagues and your customers. So that was one innovation that came out of an innovation day that we just go, this is great. Let's fund it. Let's build on this. We just want ideas to come from anywhere. So it kind of touches on the kind of team culture piece around innovation, a culture of psychological safety and learning is what we strive to have. Yeah, but the technology behind the scenes reflects that. There's a lot of open source technology, a group of different things that we use. So keeps it interesting, keeps it fun.
Yeah. That's good. And what's your approach to cybersecurity? Is there kind of a simple way you can, you know, boil down how you, you know, how you keep things in check on that front?
It's a journey. So, yeah, it's not, it never stops. We keep investing in it. We've got a 24/7 security operations center that we run both on our network and our security. We're connected in with all the industry. We kind of lead in some areas as well. So we're, you know, scam frauds and those sorts of things that we see. Our own internal security posture, it's, yeah, it is a journey. So we've got, you know, your traditional stuff that you're kind of protecting your perimeter, your internal systems, removing legacy, vulnerability management. Yeah, there's, I'd say my simple version is it's a journey. You just need to keep investing in it. And we do consider, we're, you know, we've got certain regulations and accreditations we have to adhere to. We're, you know, we serve government customers, so we're on certain panels. So we do have to ensure we're secure. But we'd happily talk to anyone around what we're doing there because we like to work out loud and share stuff like what is good practice for us, what's endpoint protection mean and how does that work. We offer managed services as well for firewall as a service and a range of other things. So happily kind of talk to anyone around that. And we do sponsor a little a hacker conference down in Christchurch called ChichCon. So if anyone's down in Christchurch that do go to that, they'll see my head of security there, Ivan, every year, and some other events. We sponsor the OWASP event as well for developer security. So there's a lot of it's actually how do you shift security left and have everyone think about it, because everyone needs to be concerned about it. It's not just one security team. So our developers are thinking about how do you build things securely. Our frontline agents thinking about data and how do we, you know, our customer data is like it's critical asset that we can't expose. So ensuring that's always protected and people are thinking about it in that way, invest a lot in awareness and training. So there's a full, and our board are really interested in it, obviously.
That's good. That's good.
There's been a lot of high profile cases in Australia, like Optus, for example, and a range of other things. So and we've got customers that are we want to ensure we can work with as well to help protect them. So we're very engaged in it. That wasn't a short answer, Paul. Sorry.
No, that's good. Oh, well, it's been really good, Stephen, to sort of, you know, delve in and to look inside 2 degrees a little bit from your perspective, wearing that sort of chief technology officer and chief information officer, those two hats. Really, really insightful. So, thanks so much for joining us on the New Zealand Tech Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Paul. Appreciate it.
Good stuff. Well, thanks everyone for listening in. And of course, thank you to our show partners as well. 2 Degrees, 1NZ, Spark, HP and Guerrilla Technology. If you've been watching the live stream, which is available across LinkedIn, Facebook, X and of course YouTube, then do make sure you subscribe or follow us through your favorite sort of audio app, whether it's Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And if you've been listening to the audio, then make sure you're following us on those platforms, YouTube, X, Facebook, and for LinkedIn. That streams out from my profile, so you can follow me, Paul Spain, on LinkedIn. Thanks, everyone. We'll catch you next week. Thanks again, Stephen.
Cheers, mate.
The New Zealand Tech Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, proactive and strategic IT.